So I figure that I won't actually finish my talk from yesterday, which had one other topic in it. Which had one other topic in it, because really yesterday was just to try and get everyone up to speed on the perspective that I come at this whole dispersion interaction perspective front. So what my talk yesterday was, its purpose was to reduce the optical contrast between all of our different people here and make it a little bit less sharp gradient. Yeah, I think we can.
Welcome again, Roger.
So therefore, today what I'm going to do is be talking about the dispersion interactions in metallic and semiconducting carbon nanotubes from ab initio uniaxial optical properties. And so this is really the thesis work of Rick Reiter, who's at MIT, and so he's already done his preliminary defense and should finish off at the end of this month. And at that point, he'll be a more relaxed individual. And so therefore, his work has actually been funded initially by the DuPont-MIT Alliance and then by the NSF NERT at Lehigh, exactly because of the driving force of processing of carbon nanotubes. Then obviously with William Cheng, Adrian, Rudy, Linda Neuer's a numerical person that we work with, and Craig Carter and Yetming Chang are Rick's professors at MIT. We've already had a good selection of papers coming out. So this is the cylinder solution right here. This is what I call the end user paper, if you just want to figure out how to use it instead of how it all fit together. And then this is the mixing paper. And right now we're working on finishing two different data mining papers and one more end user paper. One of the things I think is nice, which Rick sort of developed, and I find is just a useful thing to think of, because of course for me, I think of all of these dispersion interactions as really that nature wants to wipe out optical contrast. Optical contrast has a cost to it. And so therefore you can actually think of, if you have a box and all in vacuum, all things attract because there's a gigantic amount of optical contrast. If we make the darker colors or more polarizable or higher index materials. But now if you put an interlayer medium in here, like water, then the light thing will float, the heavy thing will sink. That's a wetting condition right there. Or if both of these materials are lighter, lower index than the medium, then they'll both rise, and again, it'll be an attraction. And it's actually it works rather nicely. It's just sort of a useful way to think of things. So the work here on carbon nanotubes, there's been work for various years at DuPont and now up at Lehigh and various other places where we've been focusing on processing and assembly technologies for carbon nanotubes. And that means you have to be able to separate them by their metallic or semiconducting type, sort them by their chirality, place them where you want them to be, and line them up. So the question came up was, can the van der Waals-London dispersion interactions be used for CNT processing? I mean, these are universal, long-range, present. But one of the things that we really needed was to have ab initio optical properties for these tubes. And with William Cheng, we've been able to open that door there. And the other thing that was needed was that we couldn't just say we're going to have two semi-infinite half spaces interacting as a layer, because of course carbon nanotubes are nothing like that. And so that was the other piece that really had to be developed. Here is the two experiments that really were what got the whole thing motivated. And this is work by Ming Zheng and others at DuPont. And basically this is anion exchange chromatography, or what we can do is just call it stick strip via screening electrostatics. So what we do is we take a beaker full of carbon nanotubes, we put them onto a column. These carbon nanotubes are wrapped with DNA, so they have a charge per unit length. And so now they're charged entities. They're going to stick down on the polystyrene beads. And then we're just going to titrate in salt until we neutralize the electrostatic charges. And the nanotubes that lift off and come out of the column as a function of elution time can then be collected together. And initially in 2003, what they found was that by doing this, you could separate the metallic from the semiconducting tubes. Very nice finding. A procedure that you could use for sorting by type. And so that was very nice. But then actually with some more years of work, they've actually found that you can not only separate by type, by class, semiconducting or metallic, but you can even separate by individual chiralities. Okay? And so therefore that brought up the question, well, do the known band gap trends contribute, or what is contributing to a mechanism whereby dispersion interaction and chirality could be assisting this type of a process? So that's what we set out to answer, and actually sort of went beyond that. You've seen this discussion from yesterday, but today what I'll do is just put up the case of polystyrene, because that's the bead material that we're using here. We published a paper last year on the properties of polystyrene for dispersion interactions. So 71 zeptojoules with air between two pieces of polystyrene, down to 8 with water as the interlayer medium. Those are both attractive. And repulsive is minus 16 zeptojoules for the wetting condition of water on the surface of polystyrene. Just getting you scaled into the size of things. So now if we want to be able to do the quantum electrodynamics for this problem, what we need to do is know how to do cylinders, which are optically anisotropic. We need to have a Lifshitz formulation for them. We need the spectra, the Van Wells-London dispersion spectra for the component materials that we're doing it in. We can then get the total energy, and we can end up getting a Hamaker coefficient for the problem. Well, I told you yesterday about VUV reflectance and valence eels, and the problem, of course, is that for carbon nanotubes, you can't measure the optical properties experimentally over the large energy range that we need. So these methods are not applicable, but ab initio band structure is. And so what we actually do here then is that we basically take graphene sheets, look at the NM that we want in a carbon nanotube, roll up the sheet, consider the cutting lines, take this to get the XYZ coordinates of all the atoms, use the LDA band structure method on the, using an orthogonalized linear combination of atomic orbitals basis set, calculate the full band structure, so that's a big calculation, and then we also calculate the full dipole matrix elements, all the transitions. We keep lots of conduction bands, empty conduction bands, do lots of transitions. As a matter of fact, calculating the dipole matrix elements is an equal amount of computational time as doing the band structure. Okay.
And is a finite length a nanotube? Or?
These are in a supercell calculation, so we put one nanotube into an empty box, and we repeat in all directions, periodic boundary conditions.
So your tubes are infinitely longer than an array of them, and
yes.
one repeat unit is your cell in that direction.
Yeah.
Could you just explain this chemical jargon, chirality NM? What do you mean?
I'll show that,
okay.
The roll-ups, in just a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Came up recently, Rudy and I were talking, the choice of the length for the box,
mm-hmm.
That's a kind of a limit of low frequency response, because mm-hmm. low frequency response for a conductor is an infinite distance.
Well, so therefore, when we do these band structure calculations, here's the nanotube, and what we have to do is we have to use a long enough nanotube so that the structure repeats along the length of the tube. So that sets the length of the tube that we're going to do. But then we're using periodic boundary conditions, so it's infinite in length.
Does that work for a conductor? Because it was, as I recall, it came out some humongous epsilon, but it wasn't infinite. It was like
no, it's not infinite,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Right.
So that's because of the box.
We'll think about this. I don't believe that's true. I think real band structures tell you the properties of real materials and idealized.
They're only as good as what you put in at the very beginning. They're only as good as your basic assumptions that you put in at the beginning.
The other important thing to think about is what we do with the supercell. We make empty space around the tube, and we actually study any changes that occur with the size of the supercell to make sure that the two tubes next to each other aren't interacting.
Oh, so your supercell has two tubes and then...
No, it has one tube, but if you change the supercell volume, then you're going to be, since it's periodic boundary conditions, there's a second tube here, another one here. They're repeated in all directions in this way.
So your band structure calculation never really directly calculates the interaction.
No, not at all. We're just wanting to get optical properties. We just want optical properties. We calculate one tube and get optical properties. That's our avenue.
Why do you need the array of tubes?
Well, it's not really an array. It's just that we have a supercell. We need 3D periodicity for the band structure, right? So here is a box. Here's our supercell like this. And then we put one tube in here that goes to the back side like that and comes out the other side. But then we're using periodic boundary conditions. So therefore, there's always another box in the calculus. That's how you do band structure calculations.
We want the dispersion in the perpendicular direction, but that's not.
We're not calculating the dispersion with the band structure calculation. We're just calculating optical properties of that one tube. We're using Lifshitz theory. Yes, they're intrinsically for periodic systems.
You have to make your system into something.
So we use a supercell calculation. And we're not using the band structure calculation to get the dispersion direction.
But it's to infinity, isn't it?
It's a periodic in all three dimensions, yes.
No, sorry, I mean the supercell size you let go to infinity.
What we do is we have studied the effects of changing the size of the supercell, how much empty space there is, to make sure that there's no effects of this artificial periodicity we're using laterally. Right.
Okay.
So if one were to half or double, for example, the size of the box,
right, there's no change.
That's
mm-hmm.
To verify that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. So what we're doing is just using band structure to get the epsilon 2.
The electrostatic boundary conditions on the solver is what are they?
It's no net charge on the system. There's no electricity. It's just a normal local density approximation band structure.
For the electrostatics.
We don't do electrostatics.
No electrostatics.
Yeah, so this section right here is very relevant and very important. What we're doing is we're calculating optical properties of a single carbon nanotube using a band structure calculation. Again, just like, yes, I didn't show any results, but we've done much work over the years of comparing optical properties quantitatively determined with reflectance and with yields. We have also done work comparing optical properties determined from reflectance, yields, and ab initio band structures. Okay?
When you say there's no electrostatics, at some point there are atoms with electrons.
Yes, there are atoms with electrons. It's a full basis set. We have all the electrons being included.
And so the atoms interact with some Coulomb.
Yeah. Right, so there's no electrostatics like I'm discussing an electrostatic interaction of two tubes or something like that.
No.
But it's a normal local density approximation band structure.
You have to impose something like tinfoil or vacuum or whatever boundary conditions on the electrostatic part.
Yeah, we require that in the unit cell.
Yeah.
Here that we put in for our band structure calculation, that there's no net charge in the system. That's a normal requirement in a band structure calculation.
And the gradient of the wave function is zero on the boundary of that cell. Is that the purpose of the cell?
The purpose of the supercell is just to give periodic boundary conditions so that you can use your normal techniques like calculating the band structure of silicon.
I mean, your nanotube really is periodic in the long
direction. In the long direction, it's periodic.
That's genuine, right.
Right. And then in the two other directions is where what we're doing is we have a box so that we make sure that they aren't affecting each other. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so all we're doing is doing a band structure calculation right here to get the properties of a single carbon nanotube, calculate the dipole matrix elements for transitions from the valence to the conduction band, calculate epsilon 2. Once we get that, then we can transform it into a London dispersion spectra. If we have the Lifshitz formulation for a cylinder, we can get the Hamaker coefficient. That's our pipeline. Let's look at it here, okay? And I'll show you these more. Basically, this is a graphene sheet. This is the little quadrant of graphene sheet that if you make any roll-up vector, say blue and red, then what you do is you roll up a graphene sheet along this vector, touching this point to that point, you'll get a 6-5 semiconducting carbon nanotube. If you roll up the sheet along this red vector, then you'll get a 9-3 metallic tube. you can see the differences in the structure, atomic structure of those tubes. Okay. We then also look at the Brillouin zone and the cutting lines. This Lambin paper is a really nice paper for discussing the mechanics of the electronic structure of the carbon nanotubes. And then we calculate the band structure right here. And so just the change, these, if you look at a constant arc length here, that's the rate, that's the circumference of a tube, right? Because I'm rolling up the tube from here to there. And therefore, you see that these tubes have almost the same circumference. But because of the changes in the bonding in the tube, one is semiconducting with a band gap in it, and one is metallic with a little band, a little small band gap, or just a band touching right there.
That's a delicate thing, which you have to have a very good band structure calculator.
Yep, and we'll show you more about these. I'll show you Drew-to-metal peaks for these things and all that. Okay? And our findings here are in agreement with the normal literature about this that's been developed. Okay? So once we have a band structure, so we go from graphene sheet, roll it up, do your band structure calculation, and then you can calculate all the interband transitions. So for the semiconducting tube, we do these in the different directions. So radial will be here as the tube, and what are the optical properties in these directions? And axial, what are the optical properties along the tube? And so here what you find is that 6-5 semiconducting tube is a semiconductor in both the radial and axial optical properties. And 9-3 metal, well, in the radial direction in black, it's got a band gap. But in the axial direction, it actually shows a Drew-to-metal peak. Okay?
You put no damping into these calculations, right? The finite value at the north comes out without...
Right.
That is something else that you'd like to understand.
Once we have the optical properties of our tubes, we can then do the London dispersion transform and get the London dispersion spectra. And I'm just including in here because we care all about aqueous systems, nanotubes in water. Therefore, I'm including water here, which basically goes up to a high value. And we can just look at these, and then we can calculate the Hamaker coefficient, in this case for these two tubes in water against gold. Okay? That's the pipeline of what we're going to be doing in the talk today.
You explained the axis on A
and B. On these three right here, this is the amplitude of the London dispersion spectrum. It's just a quantitative optical property, epsilon of I xi, and the square root of this number is like the index of refraction.
Arguments on this epsilon are only frequency.
Only frequency, epsilon of omega. This is epsilon of omega. This is epsilon of I xi.
And what does that mean for a tubular structure to have a function only of frequency?
It's just the optical properties of...
So it's based on the dipole in either direction.
Yeah, it's a dipole optical... It's the simple dipole optical properties of the tube.
So an infinitely long tube, what dipole does it develop under a uniform field? It would be an infinite dipole.
So if I take this tube and I stand it up like this and I put an electromagnetic wave onto it, what will it be? What excitations?
Uniform field, presumably, in this code, the uniform electric field.
I'm doing this as a function of frequency. So I'm going to be looking as a function of the optical frequency as I excite this. Here's my electromagnetic wave coming in. What's the response of the system?
That wave has what wavelength?
It has the wavelength given by these frequencies.
Oh,
it changes with frequencies. It's optical properties, right?
So you
red to blue to green.
So you're applying a finite wavelength, wave number along the tube.
Yeah. And these are the wavelengths right here. This is going to be just about 500 nanometer wavelength. This is going to be about 50 nanometer wavelength.
That wavelength number will, of course, go to zero as the frequency goes to zero because it's light. Okay.
Yeah, just optical. For me, being an optical properties person, it's just optical properties.
Can you explain?
We're going to see all of these in more detail as we go through.
Can you explain the geometry, what you mean then with the nanotube water gold?
Yes, well, we're going to see this and all. I'm just trying to give you a roadmap of where we're heading. Okay? So let's go look at ab initio optical properties of graphene and single wall carbon nanotubes. Okay? And so therefore, what we need is that we need to have epsilon 2, epsilon double prime spectra optical properties from 0 to 30 EV. Carbon nanotube studies, the literature is full of people using tight binding approximation calculations because they're easy to get results for carbon nanotubes, to get band structures and all the rest, and they're, you know, they're okay. I'm not against any particular approach or method. But what it does is that it basically doesn't give you information on the optical properties, and typically people only report results out of the band structure from about 0 to 6 EV. Now, this 6 EV is also the cutoff of air, and it's the end of most people's optical properties, and people get the fingerprint spectra and stuff, so that's okay. But still, this method will not be useful for getting optical properties to 30 electron volts.
It's unrealistic about the symmetry of the bands. That presumably is the physical.
Tight binding
approximation. Yeah,
tight binding approximation basically is exceedingly constrained in what it's going to allow the wave functions to do as it's calculating things.
Shouldn't change the basic symmetry, but I mean that crossing of the bands in graphene is absolutely dictated by symmetry.
Yeah, it changes the, it puts unrealistic symmetry constraints on the wave functions that you're doing and on the higher lying ones.
Yeah,
we need 30 EV properties. Okay.
Yeah.
And now, if you just take a spectrum, we've shown this in lots of cases, if you take a London dispersion spectrum, you just cut it off, and you calculate how big is a Hamaker coefficient for some system. In this case, this is done for the carbon nanotubes. If you have data that's only up to 5 or 6 EV, you get, oh, say about 60 zeptojoules. And here, as you get the spectra longer and longer, you start seeing that you need to be getting all of the interband transitions to actually get the full dispersion interaction present in the system. That's the support of that result right there. So what we do is just basically do an ab initio electronic structure calculation. We take basis sets all the way up to those 3Ds and 4Ss. We do all the single electron transitions up to 45 electron volts. We've done this and shown it for many other systems. Quantitatively, these results compare to the results measured on other physical materials. And we do full matrix dipole element calculations. Okay? So that's the background of what we're calculating.
Actually, before you go on,
yep.
What kind of lens scales would you ultimately calculate your Hamaker coefficients, and how does that compare to the size of your unit cell along there?
So therefore, because we're using the band structures just as a way to get the optical properties, then there isn't a relationship between the unit cell size that we do for the band structure calculation and therefore the optical properties we determine and where the range of applicability of the results will be. But mostly this problem, all of the results I'm showing today do not include retardation in our formulation, and we're really considering things from two carbon nanotubes in contact to things that are out to two to four times nanotube diameter. Okay, so we're in a close approach kind of regime. Okay, so let's look at graphene. So here's a band structure of graphene, okay, right there, calculated in its nice little detail. And what you find, and here is the band structure, this is the density of state, so this is the valence bands, here's the conduction bands. If you are interested in the stuff right around the Fermi level, then what you're seeing in probing are the pi-pi star transitions. So these are the out-of-plane pi bonds laterally along the graphene sheet. And you can see also that as you get up to higher energies between here and here in transition energy, this is where the sigma-sigma star transitions start. So if you're a tight binding person, you're really just paying attention to the pi-pi star transitions. Perfectly fine. But the dispersion interaction involves all of the electrons in the material, and we have to take into consideration pi and sigma transitions. Okay? So therefore, the pi bonds are from PZ, those out-of-plane PZ orbitals. The sigma bonds are the sp2 hybridization in the graphene sheet of spxpy. So now let's go look, and I'm going to be always putting up the optical properties of graphene just to give us a reference frame to look at carbon nanotube optical properties. And what I'm going to do is say, here's red, this is the in-plane direction. So graphene shows a small little gap right here, a big peak. And here are the pi-pi star transitions. And then here are the sigma sigma star transitions in the in-plane direction. I label pi naught because this is an invariant peak that doesn't shift. Here's sigma naught is another one. And if you want the out-of-plane optical properties, there's really not much going on until you get up to the green, right like this. Okay? And here we have optical properties out to 30 eV. And these are, again, similar to optical properties calculated by others. Okay? So graphene is a semi-metal in plane. It doesn't show a Drude-Metal peak, right? And its higher energy transitions basically are all coming from the sigma bonds. So there's a real difference between below 5 or 6 EV, pi pi star, above sigma sigma star. For the Lifshitz inter, for the van der Waals-London dispersion interaction, we have to think about all the electrons in the material. So now we're going to...
You're talking about the polarization of the light.
Yes, the polarization of the light. Because we're going to do all of this for optically... for anisotropic optical properties everywhere. Okay, so now here's our little roll-up sheet, and here are the carbon nanotubes that we have calculated the ab initio optical properties of. Okay, so therefore what we do, so I showed you that roll-up vector. So here are all the zigzags. They always have a zero in their NM chirality. So here's a roll-up vector to a 6-0. 6-0 is going to be a zigzag metal by its simple classification in carbon nanotube land. The ones that have N and M the same number are the armchairs going along here. Armchairs are called metals, but maybe they're semi-metals better named. Okay, be careful about this classification nomenclature. And then all the ones that aren't armchairs or zigzags and have more complex structures are the ones that are called chiral nanotubes. Okay, so for classification, all the armchairs are, quote, metallic. The zigzags can be semiconducting or metallic. And the chiral ones have very rich class of behavior.
Some of the chirals are genuine metals in that they have a finite...
Yeah, I'll show you more about those. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I'm going to also use a few of these just for examples throughout. So here is a 6.5 and a 9.3. You can see the circumference in nanometers by the roll-up vector, so the arc lines. Okay. So here's a 6.5 and a 9.3. I'm going to compare a metal and a semiconductor there. I'm also going to compare 6.5 and 9.1. These are both chiral semiconductors because these have almost the exact same band gap and radius. And also I'm going to show you one example about multi-wall carbon nanotubes with 7.0 and 16.0. So I'm just getting you framed in. Now actually with all of those band structure calculations, which Rick has been running calculations with Wei-Yim Ching for years now, just swamping. And yet we then go on and actually calculate a whole bunch more because symmetry allows us to calculate these band structures too. So we've even gone up to very large diameter. These are tubes that are 8.5 nanometer circumference, 9 nanometer circumference, 10 nanometer circumference. These are big, empty carbon nanotubes. Okay. So we actually have, this is a really beautiful set of data. So after we go on and answer our elution question to our, there's a lot more work that we do because we have such a large body of information now. So let's look at that 6.5 semiconductor and 9.3 metal, the uniaxial optical properties, epsilon double prime. This is the semiconducting tube, radial direction in black, axial direction in red. And so you can see here that there's a difference in the band gap in those two different directions. You can see that there's differences in the optical properties in the sigma-sigma star transitions. And then you can see 9.3 metal, right, that it has in the axial direction a Drude-Metal peak, and it has a band gap in the radial direction. It's very important to keep track of our orientations, right, things like that. So the radial directions have rather similar properties. It's the axial directions where there's a big difference. And for example, this peak here down at low energy ends up maxing out at about 933 in epsilon 2. That's a nice tall peak. I'm plotting to 10 here. Okay?
I'm having a conductor
933 seems small compared to
infinity. Yeah. Well, see, I don't know how to characterize myself appropriately, but I'm like a real material person, and so I've never seen a real material with an infinite property.
Yes,
you know?
If you don't put dirt into your band structure calculations, in some sense, this is not a real system. Now, I believe, in fact, that some nanotubes of finite but long length can be perfect. I think that happens because it's near to 1D.
These are perfect structures that we're calculating here.
I still find it very disturbing that you're getting a finite response at zero frequency to something with no dirt. I think the problem is that you put a thing on with a wave number q, but in response, instead of calculating the e to the I q dot r moment, you're calculating simply the z moment. In other words, the dipole moment.
I'm doing only vertical transitions. I'm doing the dipole matrix approximation. Q equals zero optical properties.
All right, so it's Q equals not.
Because my wavelength
is not really equal to the Q of the optical field, but it's Q equals
naught. Q equals zero, yes.
So that e to the IQ that
I'm doing the dipole matrix approximation.
Do I understand something missing? This is done in a box, so where Q cannot go to zero.
It's periodicity, it's infinitely long too.
You only need to take one unit cell along the direction of the carbon nanotube, right? And that's real. No quarrel with that. I think what you've done is completely right. I think the difference between what you see and what I'm trying to say, I think you should see, and I don't want to be dogmatic, just my beliefs. But I think the difference may be to do with calculating just the dipole moment rather than the...
Yes, I am using the dipole approximation as I calculate optical properties. That could be where it's coming from.
The limit of Q goes to zero instead of Q. I don't quite understand, but there's something in there which you can see, I find...
Which we should try and...
I guess I didn't understand. If you're doing your calculations with a finite box...
No, it's a block wave. You can use one unit cell. As long as you have the correct block periodicity at the end of it, then you're treating an infinite periodic system.
You're repeating the same thing again and again. It comes back to itself.
Right, so along the length of the tube, I use the length of the tube that I'm going to calculate to come up to the end of my box, that would be the repeat unit for the structure, and then it's infinitely periodic in this direction. Just like a silicon band structure, one calculates silicon band structure on a small unit cell, right? You're calculating the properties of an infinite crystal of silicon. So I'm doing an infinite length tube this way, and I'm making the box big enough so that I see no interaction, no effect of the repeated tube in that direction. Okay? So this is epsilon double prime, epsilon 2. The dielectric function is a function of frequency, epsilon of omega. Now what we do is we just do the London dispersion transform, and we get epsilon of I xi right here. This is for the 6-5 semiconductor, 9-3 metal, radial and axial direction. I just include the water spectrum on here as a frame of reference. And then we see that there are very different behaviors. Of course, this is going up much higher because of that metallic property in the axial direction. And water's spectrum in the London dispersion spectrum, LD, in the van der Waals London dispersion spectrum, has a max of 78. So the blue curve goes up to 78. The 9-3 metal has a max of 333 here. Okay? So that's a very tall peak. So now,
Thorsten's been quiet.
Oops, sorry.
But I know he's been thinking very, very carefully about what kind of power laws emerge when you have very low frequency and very high polarizability, and all these laws and stuff depend critically on whether that thing really zings off to infinity or not.
Right.
So,
questions. It would be interesting to see if you're interested in interaction at larger separations, how does the dielectric response diverges?
Yep. Farther on in the talk, for different nanotubes, I've plotted them so you can see.
Okay.
So we'll see those later on. I plotted the Drude metal peak and what its width is and how it looks for different tubes.
Okay.
And different classes. Okay. So now we got our ab initio, we can at least get the optical properties to high energy for carbon nanotubes, something like 60 of them. It's more than that. Okay. But then the problem was that we didn't have solid cylinders. We just could do Lifshitz semi-infinite half spaces, you know, separated. And so therefore, here's what we did was do, these are going to be all non-retarded solutions, and they're really done in two limits, near and far. And what we did was do it for both optically and morphologically anisotropic solid cylinders. Pay attention that we're...
So the hollowness is not specific, just a medium
right.
of that diameter and that
right.
and
so on. So Rudy and Adrian were able to come up with the solutions for the Van der Waals-London dispersion interaction of an optically anisotropic cylinder with another cylinder, either just as they're going apart this way, or also as they rotate next to each other as an angle, and also the same thing of a cylinder with a substrate which is optically anisotropic. Okay, that's what I'm going to be discussing, the next element of this pipeline. So to give you the answer first, just to get everyone started off, after a nice long many equation derivation, here's a punchline. And so therefore, this would be nice, simple, optically isotropic Lifshitz calculation. Okay, basically, there isn't any anisotropy. You just have your deltas, the spectral difference functions of the London dispersion spectra. You calculate the Hummerker coefficient. You can get the energy when you have a semi-infinite half space on the left and the right separated by some medium. That one we all know. Then also, if you just want to do two optically anisotropic right and left half spaces in which there's a optical anisotropy in plane, then all of a sudden you'll find that there is an anisotropy function gamma in addition to the deltas. And this is also a known solution. Okay? But again, you're going to have the anisotropy terms. Your spectral difference functions get a little bit more complex. The Hummerker coefficient gets calculated a little bit more complex. And now there's going to start being rotation angles. Because, of course, these two planes can rotate this way. So this would have a torque to it. And then this is the solution now for two cylinders, optically anisotropic cylinders. Now you end up with two different delta parallel and delta perpendiculars for the anisotropy function pieces. Here are your spectral difference functions. Now you've got actually two different Hummerker coefficients, well, like this one. A0 is a simple displacement one. A2 is the one that has an angle, an angular dependence to it. And you can get up to your A's and G's.
So you're taking somehow the calculation for two infinitely thick parallel systems and taking the bulk epsilons that went into that and modifying that over somehow to get the interaction between two thin cylinders.
So the,
made of the solid stuff of the same material.
I'll take a version of explaining the trick here, which is that you have a block of left-hand material which has an array of tubes in it, okay, and a block of right-hand material with an array of tubes in it. Then you take the limiting behavior as you allow the density of the tubes to go down to one tube left. And that's how we arrive at this. And then I say I'm pleased that Adrian and Rudy are here to explain the rest.
The calculation is similar to what you do if you want to derive the interaction, say, between a single atom and a dielectric surface from Lifshitz theory, right? You consider some other dilutive limit that you do here, not for an atom, but for an extended one-dimensional wire.
Because what we're doing is the left is an array of tubes, an array of tubes, then you take the limiting behavior when you get the density down to one tube left.
With the neurotic anxiety that for a gas, you go dilute enough, you then your polarizability finally goes proportional to the density.
Yes.
But for tubes, and very highly, you just said it, highly conducting, this limit becomes a little dicey.
No, that's what I think.
You certainly won't get the odd laws unless your epsilon along the tube is a function of k.
Modulo that.
All right, we're doing, for that answer, I'd say we're doing simple optical properties, Q equals zero.
Also, maybe it's worthwhile pointing out that you can only use these ansatz for either parallel nanotubes or you know, in a
plane. Or ones that have rotated in this plane.
For, you know, any.
You can't have them rotating like this.
You can't do that.
You can rotate them like this. Yeah. I'll show you, I'm going to show you more. This is, again, I'm just trying to show you the general shape, and then we'll look in better detail. Okay? So here's what we call as the devils and the deltas. Effectively, I just showed you how you can say all of these Heimlich coefficients basically have an A equation and a delta equation. But what happens is that changes in these deltas basically change how the optical contrast is weighted. So I've got two. This is a cylinder against an optically anisotropic substrate, right? And that's what you're going to get here. Here's that optical anisotropy term gamma I referred to. And for two cylinders that are optically anisotropic, here is the delta left medium, delta right medium right here, again with the angular dependence and with two anisotropy terms. Okay? So this is what we find for this solution right here. And what we find is, of course, that these Heimlich coefficients are dependent on the material properties, these optical inputs we're going to put in, and also on the geometry, because those change these spectral mismatches or these weighting functions. And there's some unusual behaviors that come out of the nature of these right here, or that one right there. Okay? So now, let's go looking at some results. So let's look at what is the surface-to-surface separation scaling. So we're just going to take the tubes and move them left, you know, separate them like that. And what is the angular dependence? Okay? So what we did was that we did two different solutions, rod substrate in the near limit and rod substrate in the far limit. Okay? And this is for the simple separation of them. And here we did also the case of angle-dependent interactions, and this is where we get the A2, right? And so this is going to be where we get the rotational results right there. And now let me show you some.
So big G is the final energy function?
Is the energy, yeah.
Systems.
Yeah, thermodynamic interaction energy. Right.
And what is far and what is near?
I've got those defined. It's basically less than one diameter and more than two diameters of the tube. So it's pretty close.
So if sine theta goes to naught on the right, parallel to your zero, you need another formula.
Exactly, because that's per interaction. You get
into
right.
So you need a different case for the strictly parallel. Mm-hmm.
So therefore, if we look here at just looking at those 9-3 metal 6-5 semiconductor tubes in water against a gold substrate, here's what we get for the Heimlich coefficient in zeptojoules versus distance. Okay, and the near limit is determined here by gamma, and the far limit is basically being determined by delta parallel. And near limit is less than two diameters, far limit is more than two diameters. Okay. And so what we see here is, one, these are appreciable interaction energies, appreciable Heimlich coefficients right there. And also that in the far limit, the dispersion interaction is larger than it is in the near limit. Right? That's just for the linear separation. When we then go looking at the situation as a function of angle, this is for the cylinder against an anisotropic substrate, okay, for a semiconductor and a metal. Very interestingly, actually, there's a bigger interaction for the semiconducting tube with the substrate than there is with the metal, even though the metal has that peak to it. So non-intuitive result, you might think. Okay. And then also, you can see that there is an angle dependence for this tube against an optically anisotropic substrate. In other words, you're going to want to rotate parallel to the optical axis of your substrate. But there's a much bigger angular dependence for the case of the metal with two tubes right here. Okay? And so therefore, this is the interaction of two metallic tubes, and they have a very large difference in their Heimlich coefficient.
So when they're
right here,
parallel, is it still true that the semiconducting tube of similar density attracts more strongly than the metallic one?
That's this condition right here, when they're parallel.
Okay.
Yeah. Zero angle between them. Two semiconducting tubes Actually, no. This is the most. This is going to be as if it was a 6-5 semiconducting raft array of tubes.
So the
substrate.
Theta down there. I mean, the substrate is what anisotropic substrate.
Yeah, optically anisotropic substrate. And this is most pi where we've put in 6-5 semiconducting array of tubes. So you have a mat of tubes that are all parallel with those optical properties, and you're watching one come down on.
Is there separation matter?
What?
Is there separation matter?
Yes, it would be, because it would affect the optical properties. What we had to do here is just make a dense array. It's like a raft.
So the substrate's always semiconducting, but you've tried various single tube.
So you could calculate any examples you want, right? Because it's just number crunching at this point.
About the metallic versus the
non-metallic.
Yeah. They were with what?
They were with these against themselves, 6-5 semiconducting cylinder coming down to a 6-5 semiconducting plane, raft.
Versus
metal.
Either both semiconducting, the substrate and the tube semiconducting, or both metallic. Well, that is interesting.
This one here is the one where we see a very large difference as a function of angle, right? And this is the one where now we're looking at a dispersion torque to align these ones. Okay? So rod substrate alignment is purely due to the optical properties interaction. Rod alignment has both optical and geometric effects to it that are contributing. So now let's go looking. So that was just getting the formulation going, solid cylinders that are optically anisotropic. Right? So now let's go looking at a few examples that we could discuss. Let's go look at that elution experiment. Are there differences in the dispersion interaction that would could be contributing to the observed results? Let's go looking at mixing, because we do need to deal with the fact that CNTs, most of all when they get larger, are hollow. And how should we handle that? For example, big ones could have water inside of them. That will change the optical contrast in the system. How would we deal with multi-wall carbon nanotubes? We'll do that with mixing. And then let's just go looking at data mining all of these tubes that we have, and what can we learn about their behavior? Okay, so we can now answer the elution question. And that's basically, of course, we just saw that both the optical properties and the London dispersion interaction varies with chirality, N and M. In fact, it varies rather strongly with very small changes in N and M. And so therefore, experimentally, it was observed, of course, that the separation is repeatable and distinct. Even between the most extreme case, early on it was just metals and semiconductors, and that was like, let's look at two extremely different tubes. But actually, Ming Zhang is able to separate 6-5 semiconductor from 9-1 semiconductor. And these are two tubes that have the same circumference, and here are the optical properties of 6-5 semiconductor, 9-1 semiconductor. They actually have the same band gap. Okay? So, you know, if you said, well, metal semiconductor, then you said, well, the diameter, and then you said, well, the band gap, all three of those things are the same here. But notice that there are changes in the sigma-sigma star transitions, the areas where these are, and there even are changes in the heights of these peaks and these positions in the pi-pi star transitions. So these are like the two most similar tubes you can think of, and yet he can separate them very nicely. And then when you look here, right, chirality gives you geometry, band structure, optical properties, dispersion interaction. Let's just look here at taking those optical properties, and we're going to just think about those axial direction ones right here. So axial and axial right here, red and blue. Here's a difference in the London dispersion in spectrum. Okay? And there's even a crossing between these, right, red and blue. So there's a noticeable difference in the London dispersion spectra for these.
This is very similar to water and ice, right?
Yeah. It's the same type of behavior right there as you see it in water and ice. But we aren't dealing with retardation in our solutions here. So you would expect retardation to play some role, too.
But the spectrum is...
But the spectrum has the same storyline. Okay?
If you didn't put in retardation, you'd be cutting out from the right...
Yes. You'd be cutting off the high energy transitions first, because they dephase first. High frequency. So therefore, let's go look at polystyrene substrate with water with those two very similar tubes, and what does the Hamaker coefficient look like at far distances and near distances. And what you see is that there's a 5% difference in the Hamaker coefficient between these virtually identical tubes. And that's enough to get a separation by elution time as we're titrating the salt and neutralizing the electrostatics. And as we go through and look at his rankings of what elute off the column coming out, we get correlations not just for these two, but for a variety of them. And not for a variety, but for a long list of them. Okay. So I think that that's really pleasing. And this is a real experimental system in which there's both electrostatics and dispersion interactions playing. But the game was neutralize the stick everything down, neutralize your electrostatics to allow a gentler force, a gentler interaction to play a role, and watch what happens. And what we find is a correlation between the magnitude of the Hamaker coefficient for different tubes and the observed things that come out.
Does the tube length play any role at all? Because you don't get uniform lengths when you create these things.
Right. In this case, typically one's using tubes and then you sonicate them to help them get dispersed, and you end up with tube lengths that are in a... It's not like you've got 10 feet in a tiny little lane. The lengths tend to be in a reasonably... but I don't know the lengths of the ones that he's seeing here. That's not a dimension that we discuss as being relevant.
Just a cookbook question. With the elutions and you have all the stuff sticking to the tubes and all that, does that get washed off so you can still keep suspensions?
So we get everything dispersed. With the DNA wrapped on them.
Yeah, right.
Stick them all down,
right.
And then start having them come off and collect the bins at the end.
But there's still stuff stuck to them.
Which ones? There's still the DNA on them.
Yeah.
Still DNA on them. Yeah.
Right. Because the thing that
DNA is a nice surfactant that helps keep them dispersed.
It's a surfactant until you're not interested in DNA, and then you're interested in CNT. There's no problem in the lab.
Uh-huh.
Can you get the DNA off after that? That's it. We've been going crazy.
I don't know the answer to that, but that would be a Ming knows that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So therefore, at least I think that we've been able to address this one right there nicely. So let's move on to it. Okay.
Is there a way to measure the energy difference between the two experimentally? In how they come up, for instance, with changing the temperature or something?
Well, one way is just the way the solution experiment watching what elutes. That is one way, but I don't know of another way. I could report it as an energy difference, yes. But to measure it experimentally, the elution is the main way that we look at this. There's also work being done on the inverse problem, which is placement and alignment and placement. And those also we have observations that are, again, tracking with the dispersion interaction. So separate them now, take a separated batch and start bringing them down and trying to align them on a substrate. And that also has been making nice progress. And these dispersion torques, when the things are far apart, are large, and that helps align them. But there's a lot of different ways to discuss how alignment is. This is the one that's, I think, the more well-constrained system.
It's aligning them on an anisotropic substrate?
Or actually just the fact that even on gold, the fact that at far limit, two nanotubes, once you have a selection that's all the same, two nanotubes have a big torque to align. And then we observe many times that when we deposit them onto gold, they are aligned. They all line up. So I have some pictures of that, but okay. So now let's move on and look at mixing. Because mixing was just one of those things where saying that we were able to solve solid cylinders is a nice thing. It's a good step forward, but carbon nanotubes are sort of not very solid. And that's one of the reasons why we were using these 6, 5, and 9 threes, because they're rather small and the center hole is small. Okay. So therefore, one of the problems we have is that carbon nanotubes are hollow. So it's not A. That's what we have a solution for. But it's B. well, we put DNA and surfactants on them. Okay, they got a coating on the outside surface. How would we deal with that? Or what about if you want a multi-wall carbon nanotube like D? Or what about if you have a big tube and you put it in water and it wants to fill up with water? Whether it does or doesn't is contentious in the literature, but still just to be able to deal with that. So we haven't been able to go beyond the solid cylinder formulations that we've done so far, okay? Because, and so we haven't been able to do something like an add a layer to add layers on the outside of our cylinders yet, okay? But what we want to do is basically use on the optic side how to come up with effective bulk average spectra when there are multiple components in a system. Like this is two different tubes together. Well, what would be the average properties of that there? What we're going to do is we're going to do this using optical properties of composites using the Brueggemann effective medium approximation. But there's two things to think about here. We have a near limit and a far limit. And so therefore, we're going to be trying to figure out how to take a carbon nanotube, say with a hole in the center of it, and figure out what its average properties would be. Okay? But what do you want to use when you're at the near limit at contact? And so, of course, at contact, these two cylinders, it's really important to keep. Here are the two tubes arbitrarily. When they come close together, we actually want the optical properties not of the average tube, but the optical properties of this graphene layer. That's right, touching up against the other graphene layer. So that's really what we want for the near limit. And we're going to be using mixing for the far limit. Okay? In the far limit, we can average the interior of the tube and the exterior graphene sheet together into a gray material and use that in the far limit. So therefore, another thing, though, is that how should you be mixing your optical properties? So a carbon nanotube has its radial direction optical property and its axial direction optical property, right? These are uniaxial materials. And so therefore, what we have to do is consider the connectivity. And so in the radial direction across the tube, we're going to mix with the Brueggemann EMA. But in the axial direction, we're going to just use a parallel capacitor mixing. So it's basically if you mix a material here that has a property of 2 with one that's 10, it's just how do you change as you change your volume fractions. Okay, so we're going to mix it.
You're not really capacitor calculations. You're talking about how you combine.
Just the sums here. Series capacitor, Brueggemann, or parallel capacitor. How am I going to mix my epsilon? Yeah. Yeah, how am I going to mix my epsilon of R and epsilon of axial and radial as I build a composite anisotropic optical property? Okay? And so what we do is that we use the parallel capacitor for axial direction, Brueggemann EMA, and the radial. Mm-hmm.
That's called harmonic mean, that one on epsilon one, isn't
it? Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm. Are these approximations, or are these guesses, or are these exact results?
No, these are effective medium approximation, so these are approximations. These are just sort of established in the literature. Brueggemann did it in 1939, and it's the one that I have always found to be the most effective for high contrast optical systems. This is an approximation.
But when you stick them into some Lipschitz formula, mm-hmm. or you have, if you were to expand it out, lots of higher powers of epsilons coming in, it's not quite clear.
Well, so yesterday...
What averaging epsilon means in terms of how you're shifting the energies.
So the straightforward Lipschitz calculation has a nice separation between the optical properties and the configuration, the geometrical configuration of the system. And so, for example, yesterday I was doing this as I made a gradient in real space between the optical properties of the medium and the optical properties of the left or right half space. And so therefore, the number of places beyond Lipschitz where this EMA-type perspective gives reasonable estimates, what it's going to be is that if the optical contrast between the two systems are small, the difference on these is not that big. It gets to be a problem when optical contrast gets to be big. But then also, as I hear people discussing infinitely conductive Drude metals, or infinitely conductive perfect metals sitting in vacuum, I get concerned about the fact that you are, not you, anyone in particular, but the community is studying systems that have such absurdly unrealistic optical contrast that the results are wildly unstable. And I wonder how they relate to more realistic quantities of optical contrast. And so,
one thing that you get currents, long-lasting currents or long the length. But this mm-hmm. is the only case where one knows about this is at the large separation.
Mm-hmm.
Close separation, I think you need to get all the other motions that the electrons can do, might
mm-hmm.
you do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think actually what one would really want is your theory of just the correction for the very small cues along the wire.
Mm-hmm. And then one of the things that I rely upon as I'm doing something like my effective medium approximation is that in realistic systems, the real world has worked hard, nature has worked hard to moderate and reduce contrast everywhere it can, and has driven things to try and get me closer to here where my error is going to be smaller or something.
But, I love you.
So therefore, I've described to you how we're doing our mixing here, so we can do things that are slightly more complex. Let's take a look at how do we do on a multi-walled carbon nanotube. Okay? And so therefore, in this case, what we've done is let's consider a multi-walled carbon nanotube, which is a 16-0 semiconductor with a 7-0 semiconductor inside of it. There's a picture of it. And so for then we've done the full band structure and ab initio optical properties for this together, and we've done it for this one and that one separately. So we have the quote correct answer for the multi-wall tube, and we have the correct answer for the two singles to the degree that we're correct about this. And let's compare the multi-wall zigzag tube here. Here we're using the fact that these tubes are efficient to calculate by symmetry with the properties of the two components. So first of all, let's just go looking at how does the LDA calculation do with this and do with its mixed properties. And so here what we have in the radial or the axial direction, let's look at the radial direction for example. The black line is the direct computation of the ab initio optical properties of the multi-wall tube. And these are the two component tubes here. And you can see that there's a relationship between them. So the black line, the direct calculation, the red and the blue, these two have very different band gaps, right? The peaks are at very different places. Okay, so you can start seeing that there's some relationship between them. And so what we're going to do is take and mix the optical properties of red and blue and see how it looks compared to black in the two different directions. Same story on here. These tubes are rather different.
Now, you show this picture with the smaller one right sitting in the center of the big one.
Yeah.
Now, is that what's used for the electronic structure calculations?
Yes.
And is it realistic that you
want to
put one side or the other?
Correct. What we did was that we basically take and put these two tubes together, and we don't let them make a closer approach between. We put them in the center of the big tube. But also what we do is we usually tend to observe the fact that the graphene-graphene sheet spacing, it's not observed that real multi-wall tubes pair up together if you can't have the spacing between the inner tube and the outer tube. If the inner tube and outer tube had to be spaced smaller than the graphene-graphene sheet in graphite.
But basically, they always form themselves with a fairly tight fit.
Or they can form with, this could be much, much bigger, and this might drop down to the side, but it'll stay farther apart or similar to the graphene-graphene sheet separation.
And then there's a place of optimal registry.
Then there's a place of optimal registry, but don't forget that this is, well, this is just a dispersion interaction, so it's not really chemical bond formation, right? So this is a rather weak interaction between this tube and that tube. And what you'll see, so we have not actually rotated the center tube relative to the outer tube.
But the high orbitals don't overlap.
In the great two-dimensionality of graphene and graphite is because there isn't really much going on. This stays pretty much independent of that, and it's just, to my thinking, it's just a dispersion interaction.
That's what the difference between real graphite being a metal and not. I mean, graphite is.
Yes, sir, there's a small amount of higher order interaction that plays a role, and I'll show you that you can see it. Let me show you that.
The interaction between the inner and the outer cylinder, isn't it? I mean, you say it's a dispersion interaction. That should be then repulsive, right, to get this stabilized or not?
If it's to stay centered, you're saying.
Yeah.
If it was to stay centered.
Why is it repulsive?
We just put it in the center here. So I can't, yeah, I'm just saying we just, for practicality,
and that's
built the model.
No.
Set. They don't allow.
We just said we didn't.
They cannot say whether it's a.
We just.
I hope it's just. I mean.
Okay. You hold it back.
Yeah. So here the okay. So let me get to the next piece over here. This is the multi-well tube calculated ab initio optical properties. Here's the two component tubes ab initio optical properties. And this red line here is when we did mixing of the optical properties of the two component tubes with the real band structure calculation for that multi-wall tube. And you can see, one, we're actually reproducing most of the shapes. So to first order mixing two tubes that we calculated previously gives us, I think, rather well the properties of the multi-wall tube. But also to the question, these differences here are the non-dispersion interaction or the chemical and chemical bonding interaction of the two tubes inside. So the differences between the EMA approximation mixing and what's actually observed would be changes in electronic structure of the in the multi-wall tube put together.
So hybridization effects between
the Yes, between, the, say, the pi orbitals and the inner tube with the pi orbitals on the inside of the outer tube. So those phenomena do exist, and we can observe them, because if it was just the simple case, then we wouldn't see these differences. But still, actually, I think that from the point of view of saying, would the red line be a reasonable approximation of the black line for cases where we can't actually calculate it, I think it would be, right? The areas of all of these features are reasonably reproduced. But there is more going on in the multi-wall tube than just a mixing of simple optical properties of independent components.
How difficult is it for the calculations to just displace the centers a little bit and see what happens?
Because we chose the simple zigzag, that was not too computationally much, but we're getting a lot of atoms in there, and then we have to calculate all the electrons. And so this is a big calculation that ran for a month or two. And so therefore, running another one to look at displacement effects is the space is large for what could be the calculations to run. On DOE Supercomputer Center and all that kind of stuff. These are.
What is the separation between the two?
So these ones we just chose as being ones in which there is that sort of graphene sheet spacing, as we just chose. We've done other multi-wall tubes too and get similar phenomena.
So what have you mentioned?
Yeah, whatever the graphene sheet spacing is, which is 1 point.
Because you could imagine the interaction being largely repulsive simply from the.
Keep it in the center. Yeah.
The repulsive component or graphite wouldn't have a natural space.
That's true.
It's
yeah.
The fact of the large distance and it forms itself. So yes.
I did the calculation for two rings for center, and the central position is unstable.
Uh-huh.
Two rings with directly boundary conditions.
Mm-hmm.
For cylinders, it's also known to concentric cylinders.
And for cylinders, probably it will be the same.
Two concentric cylinders,
yeah.
Metal.
Mm-hmm. Want to actually go off center.
Yes.
Yeah. So therefore, most probably what we've chosen as our black multi-wall carbon nanotube atomic structure might not be what the real one's like. But I think that when we're mixing spectra that look so different as the blue and the red here, different band gaps, different features, all the way up to high energy, and we can reproduce what we get there, that's a reasonable approximation.
Okay.
Okay.
I find it unbelievable.
Well, I think that's because, to my mind, these two tubes are not chemically bonding together, right?
Yeah.
You can separate multi-wall tubes into their components.
The graphite is chemical, and it's there, but it's quite weak.
It's weak, yeah.
So are there any, when you do the averaging to get from the left to the right, are there any kind of, I don't know, fudge factors that enter? Is it just a harmonic?
No, it's just.
Which of the three averaging are you doing?
Looks too perfect, I don't know.
Ah. Well, for me, I mean, so this is what we're doing right here. This is all we do. The phi is the volume fraction.
So which of the three averaging are you doing?
Which rule are you using?
So therefore, what we do, I'm going to show you results for the axial direction and the radial direction. In the axial direction, we use parallel capacitor. In the radial direction, we use Brueghel and EMA. Okay? Because that's the connectivity of the system. So that's what we're using for...
But if you would just exchange the averaging procedure, then it would look different, or...
Yeah, if we go and use series, for example, or other EMA equations, there's lots of EMA equations in the literature, it would look different.
As far as axial calculation goes, you may probably say that means that somehow additivity works.
Yes.
Because that condition...
In the axial direction, basically, it's just that we can add them together in a simple sense.
If your field is trying to push electrons between the two shells, of course, the little bit of bonding will make a difference, and that's probably what you're saying.
But the radial, it's not as good. I mean, it's very good, but not perfect.
It tests the chemical aspects of it. Yeah.
And for the radial directions, there's many different ways to... There's many different effective medium approximation equations, Brueggemann, Lorentz, Maxwell, Garnett, etc. And I have just, as an optical properties person, have always had my best, most reasonable success and outcomes by Brueggemann. It's just a matter of how much is it great, does it vary between the series and the parallel limits. Okay? Now, what we're going to do is we'll use this mixing for large tubes as we go forward when we look at things. Let's go look at some data mining. Let's just go look at the properties of all of these tubes that we've done. Okay? And then, unless I've already wildly run over. And so we have the optical properties of all these carbon nanotubes and many different multi-wall tubes. And of course, let's see, if you started out, everyone just told you, oh, some are metals and some are semiconductors, and that little roll-up sheet, you know, the graphene sheet vector roll-up thing told you which was the metal and which is the semiconductor. And I used to think I understood what a metal and a semiconductor were. And then they started introducing these names, you know, like that. But actually, I think that the world is sort of much more complicated. So let's go looking at some trends with radius and with chirality. And actually, so what is a metal? Because these have got to be some of the most unusual non-metal metals I've seen and things like that. And one of the problems is that people name the metals and semiconductors by doing electrical transport type measurements. And so if you sit there and you basically get some conduction down the tube, that's a metal. Well, of course, all of these in the radial direction are semiconducting. And electron transport is not a majority property of a material. It's a minority property of a material, which only is affected by the electrons at the Fermi surface, Fermi level. And so therefore, to my mind, it's not a very overall statement about a material, but the London dispersion interaction is something which involves all of the electrons in the material. It's a majority property. There's a big difference between those two ones. So as I was looking at this, I always said, okay, and I, from the optical perspective, a drude metal, that's a metal, I'll believe it. But then we're going to find that the world's sort of more complicated. One of the real things to pay attention to here, and here I'm just showing you the graphene sheet roll-up vector thing, but let's just look at two different zigzags, right? 6-0 is a metal, and 7-0 is a semiconductor. There's almost no difference between them right here. So 6, this one, and that one. Okay? And what it is when you look in Brillouin zone, here's the Brillouin zone of these, and this would be 6-0 metal. There's the 6-0 metal. So this is a band touching a gamma type band structure right here. And then here, and with another band right up like that. go to 7-0, slightly different roll-up vector, okay? And all of a sudden what you have is that the cutting lines no longer go through the corners here. And so therefore all of a sudden you open up a gigantic band gap. This is the semiconductor, this is the metal. Right there. And so therefore small changes in N and M change the XYZ coordinates, therefore the cutting lines, therefore the band structure, and everything else. So very small changes in how you've rolled up your graphene sheet just immediately jump you from one class to another class.
The worrying thing is that you find that the semiconductor one attracts much more strongly than the metallic one.
Uh-huh.
That is a surprise. You've got a system
I don't think that you could act
polarizable and yet attracts more.
Mm-hmm.
That's counterintuitive.
But it's not, if you only think of things in the simple classification of a perfect metal or a non-metal, but the reality is that all those sigma bonds play a big role, and both of them have it.
You do have a big peak, it might not be literally infinite, but you
yeah.
still have a big peak.
Yeah.
And somehow you're saying that
yeah.
the global weight of all the rest of
so
it.
So now let's find out whether that 9-3 metal that I was showing you, that's a chiral metal. Is that one that has a big drew-to-metal peak, or does it actually have a slightly more complex behavior? I'll show you that in a moment. So what we do is say, let's try and get a little bit more diverse in how we think about these things. There's lots of the single these classification schemes. Most of them are just that 0 to 5 eV band gap and conduction. We have to think about all of the properties, right? And so therefore, what we want to do is basically say that what you want to do is think about the low energy properties that are related to electronic conduction, metal semiconductor or small gap semiconductor or semi-metal, whatever you want to call the oddballs. And then also pay attention to the fact that the 5 to 30 EV, the sigma-sigma star transitions, are the ones that are correlated to structure. I'll show you this. And we have to be careful to integrate both of these ideas into it. So let's try and think about things. Are they an electronic conduction metal? And what's their structure? And that's the kind of the hierarchy that you can start looking at things. So let's look at some zigzag versus armchair nanotubes. Okay? And here we're looking from 0 to 5 EV. So this is the electronic conduction area, right? Not that it's metal, not that it's necessarily metal. And these are a whole bunch of tubes. Right here, 19, 19, 20, 20. You can see the NMs right there. And this is where pi naught peak is. That's the invariant peak in the pi transitions. And then these are the peaks that all shift. This is 1, 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 5, 5. So these are the fingerprint peaks that people use to sort nanotubes when they do optical measurements in the infrared. And these trend very nicely with N and M. That's how people separate tubes and recognize them, right? And over here, if you look at armchairs up in the structure part, the classification part, all of these tubes here are considered metals in the simple metal or semiconductor class. Note that none of them have a drew-to-metal peak, right? And they all have this type of a shape up for the sigma-sigma star transitions. Here, if we look at the zigzags, right, which are the 26 zeros and stuff like that, well, we see some behavior here. Here's that pi naught peak that's invariant, and a wide variety of behaviors down here.
Still no
drew to peak in these guys right here. That's coming down right there. Okay, I'll show you some more. Don't worry, you'll see.
These are ones you wouldn't call them.
Right, these are the semi-metals or the small gap semiconductors. And another thing is that a lot of the literature is tight binding and only looks at densities of states. And so they would say it's a low density of states at the band gap. But actually some of these have an appreciable density of states at the band gap, but the dipole matrix element is very small or non-existent, so there's no optical property there. So it's not just density of states, which the tight binding people can discuss, but you can evaluate. Yeah, you.
It's the ability of the field to get the electrons across the gap.
Yeah.
Is really important.
Yeah. And so therefore, and also notice here that these two structures here are different, and they have a different shape to them. So therefore, what we've got is there's nice trending in these classes here. The armchairs and the zigzags, they're different from each other. These ones down here are all both metals and semiconductors. So let's go look in detail at a few of these blowing up the energy scale for true to metal likers, right? And so here we're looking just to 3EV. So armchair and zigzag. All of these curves here are of what would be classified as metals, metallic tubes. Okay? So the two ones I pulled out here are armchair and zigzag. Neither of these have a Drude metal peak at all. Okay? 24, 24M, 120M, so that's the zigzag right there. And they're rather different. But now here, go over to these two zigzags. Zigzags, I didn't choose the same one here, 12, 15. So therefore, the big zigzag, black line, does not show a Drude metal peak. But as the diameter of the tube comes down and it gets smaller in the zigzag structure, all of a sudden we get a real Drude metal peak. So large zigzags, so even the class of zigzags isn't all behaving with a Drude metal peak or not. All of these are metals, don't forget. These are all classified as metallic tubes. And then even more interesting, as I, you know, if you want to see where they are right here. Even more interestingly, the chiral ones, which are really in some ways the most interesting, your most complex structures, here are two of them right here, 10-4 and 8-2. And the 10-4, is another one, is a different one right there. It has a Drude metal peak that shoots up. But here's the 8-2. So it has a big red peak that shoots up. And yet it actually drops down and shows a small gap that's something like 0.04 EV. Yeah, these are all from the band structure.
You can see the gap on the
Yeah, there's a little mini gap that opens up. Even though there's a Drude metal peak here, there's a little mini gap that shows that opens up right there. And it means that at 0 EV, this one's not a metal, even though it has a big Drude metal peak. So that's a rather rich set of behavior among your metallic tubes. Yeah?
For this type of Drude metal nanotubes, you would expect a different, say, London or Casimir interaction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So have you seen this? Or have you looked at this case?
So therefore, right, all of... so. We've all been working on this for 5 years or something, I think, with Rick, the grad student doing this stuff. And it's all coming together now. But the data mining part of this is a lot more to go into. And we're going to make these spectra available to everyone and stuff. So that, therefore, on whatever Monday and Tuesday, when I started seeing how people were talking about Drude metal peaks and the widths and how tall they were and all that, was when I asked Rick just to put these together. He just grabbed these out. But it's actually data mining is really what we do as we're looking for these trends, and we just script it all and look through all the properties of the whole sets of families. And so therefore, right here, just to get a little bit more from these simple examples. So these examples are rather, he just knew that he had seen these behaviors so he could grab these ones. But then what Rick just did, okay, be careful about this. These are all the tube radii, big to small. And this is a log axis of epsilon 2 peak height. Okay, so be careful, right? And basically, this is now summarizing over all the tubes by type. Armchairs, chirals, and zigzags, because we wanted to get out the information out of the 60 that we have, okay, from their optical properties. So therefore, those armchairs, really none of them show a Drude metal peak. You go look at them at zero. They don't have any epsilon 2 there. Okay? But also, I pointed out... I pointed out that, for example, that red one has a peak, but then it actually literally at zero has nothing. But what we're going to do is count the height of how tall it really got to.
What energy is the peak approximately?
0.05 EV, 0.04 EV. I think these are real... What? We've been careful about that. So we've gone to massive numbers of K points and sampling things very carefully and things like this.
The gap you're seeing is pretty believable.
Yeah, and it behaves across. So now, take a look across all of them. The armchairs don't show a Drude metal peak. The zigzags show a Drude metal peak as we go down in size here, right? And the chirals, who are the ones that have the most unusually strange structures, are the ones that actually all, the chiral metals, we've only pulled out the metals here, show big Drude metal peaks that are on the order of 1,000 to 10,000. That's big.
So okay. If you take a chiral metal, which is the one that's closest to being metal, and most people understand it.
Yeah. Even over a wide range of radii.
Geometrically closest semiconducting one that you can find. Do you still find that the semiconductors attract each other more strongly?
That's a question. That's a good question, but that's a question we would have to ask and come out.
Very large separations is almost certainly the opposite of that. But of course,
yes.
Short separations is up for these details.
Yeah.
It's extremely interesting.
So over the time that we've been working on this problem, right, we started out this problem with massive missing things, no ab initio optical properties, no cylinder solutions, and we just randomly chose that 9-3 metal and 6-5 semiconductor as two characteristic, a metal and a semiconductor. It turns out that the 9-3 metal is one of these anomalous metals. Okay, so it's not the one to draw your final conclusions from, and heightens why you really need to do this kind of data mining and try to get average behaviors out. Okay? And so, therefore, but so I think that you know.
Any idea of why 1,000, not million, not one?
No, that's a good question. I believe that, to my experience, because working with Wei Yim over now, we've been working together for 20 years or something, his calculated optical properties done in these ways basically lay on my optical properties, other than his band gap will be 35% smaller, which is a standard local density issue. But the Y scale will come up quantitatively right. Now, looking at these metallic systems and stuff like that, we obviously don't have experimental data for these things. So it's not a question we can answer at present.
So, I mean, you'd need to make sheets or bulks of these tubes before you could measure the optical properties. Then, of course, the screening properties would be really different. So maybe you can't measure it at all that way.
So here's just a simple attempt to classify the different types of nanotubes. Those armchairs, here's the densities of states, or the, you know, right there. And then here's the optical properties that we see. The armchairs have a simple band crossing right in here, and then they basically...
optically forbidden, just the same. Right?
Yeah. And so therefore they don't show any peak down here until you get up to higher energy. Band crossing, no Drude metal peak. I call them semi-metals. He calls them small gap semiconductors. Okay? The Lambin paper that I cite in here is really quite nice. The zigzags sometimes have an epsilon 2 spike. Okay? They're characterized by band touching like a gamma. Okay? So they may or may not have a Drude metal peak. They might be metal or semi-metals. And then the chiral ones, many times they always have an epsilon 2 spike, okay, but they might show a small gap opening up.
So it might go back down to zero.
Might go right down, yeah, just like that one I showed you right there. And so these might be small gap metals, okay, and things. And then I think that we're most probably want to stop because we've gone long.
I was
going to
ask you, do you have 80 or...
No, there's one more, six more view graphs. But.
Could of course change it. I mean,
we will
stop later.
There's one more segment of data mining topic, and then I'm done. Or we can just stop.
Just finish. Of course, our lunch discussion is anyhow.
Yeah. So here we have lunch discussion with view graph, right? So here are what we've done now. Let's just go look at some of those armchair semi-metals, okay? And this is another way to try and data mine and look at all of our properties. So this is the axial direction. Here's the radial direction. The red curves are the results for the carbon nanotubes. And here we're just animated all of the optical properties as a function of NM. You can see the NM number right there. And so here is those simple fingerprint peaks rolling in up to the pi naught peak. This is the pi, here's the sigma. And when these numbers get small, big tubes show nice simple trending behavior. But as the tube gets tight, we're causing a lot of distortion and we're causing a lot of hybridization, bond strain rehybridization, sp2 goes to sp3, and the peaks get all kind of crazy in how they behave here as you get down to small tubes. See that? Okay? So that this is one that I just put up on my screen and watch, because you can start seeing what's really going on as you've rolled really tight.
There's diamond-like coordination going on.
Yes, as you get to very small tubes, you start basically switching over from sp2 to sp3. You start mixing the pi and the sigma bonding. Okay? And you can look at again in the radial direction. And so that last spike is not like it's all a glitch. It's instead that's the tightest tube. Okay? So that's the behaviors, and again, we're always doing them large to small. 3-3 metal, 24-24 metal. But also notice that these are the ones that never have a Drude metal peak. So again, another way to check here, just watch down at the bottom. Okay? That's the trends of those armchair metals that basically, okay, here is the pi naught peak that basically stays constant with radius, and then these are all the different peaks that this roll as you change the radius of the tube. Okay, in the axia in the armchair, here you can look also that for the high energy transitions that are more structure related, you can see that there's simple trending when it's a wide diameter tube, but basically below about 0.7 nanometers, all the bunches of peaks appear. Okay? Again, as you're changing the diameter here, what you're doing is adding, increasing the number of cutting lines. You're always going through the gamma, the symmetry points in the Brillouin zone, but there's just a lot more of them. Here was the other one, which is that as you see those simple changes in epsilon, that leads to changes in the height of the London dispersion spectrum. And that means as you roll transitions to the left, the black boxes, you run up these. So this is trending behavior that you would see in your dispersion interaction. That means also that when you look at the Hammacher constant, again for these armchairs, basically there's a simple relationship between the magnitude of the Hammacher coefficient increasing as the radius gets smaller. And if you wanted to, in vacuum these are all attractive, but if you wanted to and you can tune the properties of your intermedium, you could make some of them repulse and some of them attract. That's another way to separate them, by doping in the water to change the properties. And so therefore, just in conclusion, that's effectively what we've been talking about all day, is take the atomic structure, get your band structure, optical properties, the dispersion spectrum, have your right formulation for Lifshitz, and get out the properties like that. About the only other things I say is that the carbon nanotubes exhibit very complex behavior, right? I don't really see them as being Drude metals, because even when they do have a peak, they have a whole bunch of other structure going on in the electronic structure, which I'm not sure that you could just forget about, right? Very rich range of behavior. Don't forget that we have to consider all of those transitions, right? Because that's the majority property argument. And
just at small separations, that's true. Large separations, I think, the van der Waals physics starts picking out the low energy ones.
Yeah, but then you'd have to be getting to 10, 20, 30 nanometers, 50 nanometers. Yeah. Okay.
In fact, that's what I estimated for my simple calculation.
Okay.
About 24 tube radii. I thought this was a very small tube. I start to get the funny stuff dominating. So.
Another thing I'm struck is just that using a Drude metal model and doing it in vacuum, that's sort of a most extreme situation to live at, because it's extremely high optical contrast. You have no medium that's shielding anything down and getting things to be more realistic. So I don't know whether it's a realistic model to look and compare to real material system measurements like of forces and things like that. So maybe I'm just drawn to the fact of thinking of it this way. And wouldn't it be better to use a medium and more realistic contrast, and then you can also even have your many body effects again if you're trying to compare to real physical measurements of forces by in the real world with realistic contrast and intervening mediums. And so force measurements can be affected by other things like charging, right? But don't forget that the multi-layer effects. So therefore, all the things I talked about yesterday were basically just by adding layers of extra material on surfaces of things. And it completely changes because of the way that the scaling of the distances goes and thicknesses goes, that you can change all of your interactions just as you do things. So I'm sort of, you know, wondering a little bit about that. And at that, I think that's it.
Wanted to make one comment regarding unrealistic model. I agree that it may not be a good thing to calculate for real materials.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, since you can do exact calculation, then you can test other methods that you are using.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a limiting behavior is
so if the
in a nice way.
You are using fails in that limit.
Yeah.
Well, that tells you something.
Correct. Limiting behavior is quite useful. There is a bunch of cases earlier on that I pay attention to, for example, the AFM people, the surface force apparatus people. And then when I started looking at, once we could do add a layer, which we've been able to do for a long time and have multiple layers on surfaces, I started calculating Heimerker coefficients by adding extra layers of surfactant and crud. And instead of just having 1, 2, 3 like Lifshitz gave us, and you start adding layers of materials on surfaces, which everything has a layer of hydrocarbon on it and stuff, all of a sudden all the trends that seem to correlate, say, between someone's physical measurement and what people calculated with a three-layer model, everything got much more complicated, and the correlations or the comparisons were no longer as clean and stuff. Limiting behavior, most of all in the cases of high contrast, that's definitely relevant. The comment here is more of then trying to map that onto someone's force measurement in which the liquid or whatever they're working in has impurities in it that layer on surfaces and stuff like that. That's a bigger part.
Yeah, but the point, I guess, is that you do make all of these calculations, but then there's a crucial step in your theory where you calculate the Heimerker constants. And that has not been compared with the experiment either, as far as I can see.
Right. Yep.
So,
totally, I agree.
Mm-hmm. So there's, you are mm-hmm. sort of criticizing one type of theory
yeah.
while using another type of theory.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. And so I'm not wanting to criticize. That's why I'm only comment. You know.
There are two places where I'm absolutely impressed.
Let me just finish that one though, because what I've definitely done is to say, okay, I'm going to adopt this Lifshitz engine, because then I can do inputs and get outputs, and then I can look for correlations between observed trends with what people talk about, and I would love to know whether or not my engine that I chose is a sensible one, a reasonable one, and what are its limitations. Because once I have a good engine, being the person I am, I'm going to drive it as far as I can to see what I can make insights from. And I don't truly understand what its nature and characteristics are.
Mm-hmm. So I reckon you've got 99% of the physics right, and it's extremely impressive that you've got all these realistic properties. You must have had a lot of crunching to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But there are two places that I would say, and these are both for when you've got the things that are really metallic, that have a big at or near the larger constraint, and there are some systems which have that. There are two places where I worry. One is, as I said, maybe this business of you just using dipole moments. But the other is more fundamental in a sense, that for anisotropic metals, I don't believe the transferability between different geometries that's intrinsic to the way you do things is valid. In other words, the screening is so different for thin for nano-thin metallic materials, mm-hmm. either sheets or lines, the screening mm-hmm. physics is so different in the real geometry from the geometries that one is trying to compare, mm-hmm. but I don't believe it's transferable. So those are the two places. However, mm-hmm. I think if what I say does turn out to matter, it can be fixed fairly easily mm-hmm. by an idealized calculation with just the gross metallic properties pumped into it, of the very small Q behavior along the wire, more along the lines of what I or Torsten or mm-hmm. other people do. So, in other words, I think if there is anything to this modest separation, mm-hmm. I think it would be relatively easily fixed. Mm-hmm. So you've still got, mm-hmm. you've got 99% mm-hmm. of the right physics there, mm-hmm. and if that last percent is different, I think yeah. there's probably a simple way of fixing it.
Yeah.
So therefore
we should discuss and figure out and see what we could do or try to do about it.
I think that would be a lovely thing to try.
But also for me individually, it's sort of like I can't really address whether or not it's the right way.
Let the theorists have their own decisions about it, and if anything useful comes out of it, then you can use it.
Uh-huh.
And then there's the other thing, I'm just remembering looking up epsilons in the handbook. And they're always measured at finite frequency. Yeah. Yes, somebody who really measures epsilons, and he said, you can't measure them at low frequency no. because of everything else going on.
Yeah.
It's the same place.
tricky place, yeah. Right. It's a very tricky place. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.